Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out. Today on Press Play, we revisit some of our favorite conversations about movies and the business of movies from outer space to inside the studio gates. First, Hollywood is notoriously male-dominated. We'll talk with a woman who's cracked the celluloid ceiling to write a superhero action movie, Guardians of the Galaxy. Then producer Kathy Schulman is the only woman to single-handedly win a Best Picture Oscar. We'll talk to her about why there are so few women working at the highest levels of film. And Dear White People, it was a Twitter feed, then it turned into a satirical film that looked at Black identity at a preppy white college campus.
I had a half row, okay? So it was deep enough for, you know, a white finger or two to find its way in there, but it wasn't the big, you know, giant monstrosity that Lionel has to wear.
Finally, we meet future folk. They came from outer space to conquer Earth, but fell in love with our planet when they heard bluegrass music. That's all coming up after this news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Of the 250 biggest films last year, just 10% were written by women. Just one example of something known as the celluloid ceiling. 6% of the movies had women directors, 3% had women cinematographers. But one of the biggest releases of this summer is helping to break through that ceiling for women screenwriters.
So here we are. A thief, two thugs, an assassin, and a maniac. But we're not going to stand by as evil wipes out the galaxy. I guess we're stuck together. Partners.
Guardians of the Galaxy. It's a Marvel superhero epic with a sci-fi spin, and it was co-written by Nicole Perlman, who is here with me in the studio. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, my pleasure. First, let me get your reaction to those statistics that I just mentioned, especially when it comes to the writing side of things.
It's not very surprising, unfortunately. It's sort of something that you notice. There's a lot of us wearing horn-rimmed eyeglasses, and not that many of us are women.
Yeah. So what is it like to try to break through and to say, look, you know, I'm qualified, I've got this great script, and, you know, you're talking to a bunch of white men?
I think it's interesting. Usually the writing stands for itself, but when you're in a pitch situation where you are kind of putting on a show for what you would like to do with a project, I think it comes into play a little bit more there, because they're taking more on faith that you will be able to pull off what you say you're going to do. Whereas if it's on the page and people love what's already written, I think it's a lot easier. But so much of this business is pitching and people, you know, taking a risk on a new person and on a new voice. So in that regard, I would say that women have a little bit more stacked against them if they're writing in a genre that's not typically, you know, a romantic comedy or a genre of that sort.
Which is what you're doing.
Yes.
So how did you manage to break through? And I mean, this is not just a little movie for your first film that, not the first film that you've written, but the first film that's been produced that you've written. This is a major blockbuster.
Yeah, it's kind of doesn't get bigger than this, which is amazing that this is the first project that that's been produced of mine. Most of my scripts before that had been much smaller biopics, projects about scientists or space in some way. And this has been kind of my niche from the beginning. I've never been able to really see myself as a romantic comedy writer. And people have sent me books and said, "This, you know, we'd be interested in having you adapt this." And I said, you know, I'm not really going to do a great job on this project. I tend to gravitate towards projects that are less stereotypically feminine. So sometimes that works against you, sometimes it works for you, but I've been pretty consistent in staying true to my geeky roots.
Uh-huh. And so in this case, why were you picked, do you think?
I think I was picked because, you know, there was there was a program at Marvel that was looking to foster people wanting to develop their lesser-known properties. So for a short period of time, Marvel had this situation where they hired four or five writers, and we each got a campus office, and we got to choose from a list of, you know, maybe half a dozen different properties that Marvel was interested in potentially making one day. It wasn't 100% sure, but I chose Guardians on the list. And I think maybe people were a little surprised by that, because there were other, there were female lead characters and there were characters that were better known. And I went for the one with the talking raccoon.
Really? Was that the appeal?
Yeah. Well, I think it was that it was most the most science fiction oriented. And I really wanted to take that step from focusing purely on, you know, engineering, technology, astronauts, and biopics, and these things that I love, and I sort of grew up with going to a larger science fiction realm, a lot more popcorn. And I think also it's hard to, in Hollywood, it can be hard to get people to take a risk on a big budget science fiction film if you're untested and you don't have any experience in that genre, and especially as a woman, I think. So that's why I leapt at the chance to go for Guardians.
You know, often these big movies, they have lots and lots of writers and they go through various iterations of scripts and that kind of thing. How true to your vision is the final product?
I think it's very true to my vision. It has the characters that I chose for the team, because a lot of people don't realize, since Guardians doesn't have a huge following as a comic, that there are dozens of Guardians characters. Over the years, there have been many characters who come in and off the team. So sort of choosing which characters I wanted to focus on with the movie, what the relationships were, rebooting Peter Quill's backstory, which is different than it was in the comics.
And who's Peter Quill?
Oh, he's the protagonist. He's our dashing lead, played by Chris Pratt. So
Chris Pratt from Parks and Rec?
That's right, yeah. So I think that there's quite a bit that made it to the screen, and I'm very happy with it.
Yeah. And this, so you say there are lots of characters, so that says to me that there could be lots of sequels.
Oh, definitely.
This could be a franchise.
I think so. I think that based on the reaction that people have been having to the movie so far, I'd be surprised if we didn't have a sequel at some point in the upcoming Marvel slate.
And you said that your specific interest is in science fiction and in science and technology, mm-hmm. and in doing those kinds of biopics. Mm-hmm. And is that something that you've been drawn to since you were young, that you've been interested in science? And how did you get into this in the first place?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My background is from Boulder, Colorado, is where my family is right now. And my father ran a science fiction book club. So I grew up with all these aerospace scientists from the Boulder, Colorado region and rocket scientists coming over to our house and talking about sci-fi they were reading and, you know, physicists they had studied under at Caltech or MIT. And I kind of just absorbed it and absorbed the stories that they were telling. And one of the stories they told me about was Richard Feynman and what it was like to have classes with the great Richard Feynman. And I became a little bit obsessed with Richard Feynman. My dad got me the books, his autobiographies, for my 16th birthday, and I had a big crush on this dead physicist. So all my friends had pictures of, you know, pop stars and Keanu Reeves on their wall, and I had these grainy Caltech printouts from their website on my walls of Richard Feynman playing the bongo drums. So that was kind of how I got into it, was having a crush on dead physicist. So.
And didn't you write a biopic about
him? I did.
Him?
Yeah, I did. So, which may have life in it yet. It just got reoptioned. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. So how do these things, you know, live and die? This one in particular, I think it went pretty far. Mm. Wasn't it about the Challenger?
It did. Yeah. It had quite a lifespan. I wrote it actually when I was back in college, and it was the launching point for a lot of my career, actually. And it had several directors attached, several actors attached. But that is a tale of woe that will curl your hair if I tell you that story.
I kind of want my hair curled.
It went through a lot of different issues with various chain of title that needed to be cleared. And just when we mm-hmm. got the rights back, the original financing company went into bankruptcy court and we had to buy the rights back after they got out. And it took a year. And, you know, all these things happen. This is a very common tale of woe.
So given the fact that you went through years trying to deal with this and trying to get that made mm-hmm. and other projects as well, And then all of a sudden, here comes this other thing, Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, did you just think, what's happening here? How did this happen? You know, maybe not easily, but more easily than these other projects.
Well, it's kind of amazing that a project that is such a huge budget blockbuster, that is a really big risk in the sense that it doesn't have a lot of public knowledge, or pre-knowledge of who these characters are, became the thing that happened first, compared to a very low budget movie that I think is very tellable and very relevant. But I'm thrilled that it happened, and I'm excited about Guardians. And it would be very, very funny to me if Guardians and Challenger both came out, within a reasonable amount of time to each other, because it shows that women can write all sorts of things. They can write small biopics about scientists, and they can write big blockbusters with talking raccoons. I think it's nice to be able to stretch the genre in that way.
You know, women are very well represented in other writing professions.
Yes.
Journalism, for example. Literature, for another example. But so why is it that in Hollywood they're so underrepresented?
That's a really good question. I think Hollywood tends to be a little bit more old school in some senses. I think that women, even though women were screenwriters back in the old MGM studio system days, it's the movies that get made most easily tend to be comedies and action movies and thrillers. And these genres don't have a lot of women writers in them. And I don't know necessarily that it is just a function of women not being given a shot. I think that women don't tend to gravitate towards that as much, maybe because they think it will be harder for them to sell it, or because they're not encouraged to write in these genres. And I know just as many women who love science fiction as men, and I know just as many women who love thrillers as men, but for some reason, I haven't met that many women screenwriters who are working in the genre, and it's something that I would like to change.
And how do you change that?
I think it's a perception thing. I think it's just knowing that it's not that hard to break in once you have something out there. I think it's I never had anything else on my slate that I was trying to sell that was different. I think this was, maybe in some ways it helped that I was a woman, because that was a bit of a novelty to it. But I do look forward to the day when it's not, women as a novelty writing outside in their genre. I think it's something that we have to make normal and have it be an unremarkable thing that women are writing comic books and women are writing comic book movies. I think that some of the best work that's being done right now in comic books is being done by women. A friend of mine, Willow Wilson, has rebooted Ms. Marvel as a Muslim teenage girl, and it's selling, gangbusters, and it's doing really well and getting great reviews. And I think that every time something like that happens, it makes it easier for women to make inroads in these genres. And so hopefully Guardians will be somewhat like that.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And congratulations.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Nicole Perlman may have won a battle for women in Hollywood, but the war isn't over. Only about 15 of the 250 top grossing movies in America were directed by a woman last year. One reason? Financing. Movies with male directors get more money from foreign investors. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, this past summer, Guardians of the Galaxy was a big hit at the box office from Marvel. I spoke with the film's co-screenwriter, Nicole Perlman, about how unusual it is for a woman to write a superhero action flick.
So much of this business is pitching and people, taking a risk on a new person and on a new voice. So in that regard, I would say that women have a little bit more stacked against them if they're writing in a genre that's not, a romantic comedy or a genre of that sort.
Well, statistics say it's even harder for women directors to break through the celluloid ceiling and get jobs running studio films. Last year, of the 250 top grossing films at the domestic box office, about 15 of them were directed by women. And while it's true that Kathryn Bigelow won an Oscar for Best Director in 2010 for Hurt Locker, she's still the only woman ever to do so. Kathy Shulman is an Academy Award-winning producer and president of Mandalay Pictures. She's also the president of Women on Film. That's an organization dedicated to improving opportunities for women filmmakers. She visited us here at KCRW Studios, and we talked about that issue. Why don't we begin with where things stand right now? So Kathryn Bigelow, only woman to win Best Director, Academy Award. She and you are the only women to win for Best Picture. You won for Crash. So that's a small number of women in the grand
history.
I'm
actually not the only woman to win for Best Picture. There were three others in combination with men who won Best Picture awards in the past. I think one of the things that made me unique was that it was alone as a woman, and I had no other relationship with the man.
Because that is an issue, right? That Hollywood films, it's hard to get financing if a man isn't attached, if you're a woman
producing
a movie.
I think that's right, yeah.
Well, tell us what's happening then, because there are more women writers, and there are more women directing documentary films.
Yes.
So why is it that women aren't directing major feature films?
Well, in the research that Women in Film has done, and we've done it in a partnership with the Sundance Film Institute, we've gone through over 30,000 data points on an annual basis. And I never think these things are entirely statistically based and that any one thing exists without many related other things. But the single biggest obstacle for women is access to primarily male-controlled networks of financing. So the issue is not one of, are the women good artists? Are the women available or whatever? It's why can't they get the money? And what's also very measurable and completely true at the moment is that as economic risk increases on projects, the amount of women involved decreases. So, for example, we're seeing at film schools 50-50 male-female directing movies at film schools. By the time we get to the major studio films, we're at under 4%.
So let's tease that apart. It's the financing.
It is.
And so you have these male-dominated networks of financing.
Yes.
And so how does it go from that to we're not going to give money to a woman director? What do they say? What is their calculation?
Yeah, their reasons seem to be what I would call mythological, to be honest. All it is their hearsay, what they say they think is true. And the top reason seems to be that women multitask and are managing home and family and work, and that there's a fear that large amounts of money under control by a woman, that money runs the risk of being disorganized, distracted, not cared for due to multitasking of women.
Wait, do they actually say that?
Well,
the financiers, they actually say those words?
Yes. And it's not only men who say this. Women say it too, who have control of financing. It's like we know that a guy can go out there and devote 100% of his attention to this, and we just don't have to add any other areas of concern or risk. And I don't think there's any like woman hating going on, or if it is, it's so subliminal. Or it could exist, but no one talks about it. But what I really think is we've been making movies for boys and men for a long time as a trend. So that, by nature, male concepts, male ideas for males attract males and male financing, et cetera, et cetera. And the other problem, which is probably more significant right now, is that the way that movies are funded today is based on almost 80% of foreign funding. We don't go to studios anymore, say, here's my script, and then they give you $80 million cash. They create a business plan that's valued on the basis of how it's going to operate internationally as the majority. You know, if we go back just as far as really the 90s, we valued the U.S. distribution as the majority piece of the financing puzzle. But now it's so clear to us that about 80% of the economics surrounding a movie and all of its ancillary potential are foreign-based. And there's two sides to that equation. There's who's selling the movies on behalf of the U.S. financiers and who's buying them on behalf of the international financiers. You know, I know of two prominent female salespeople on the U.S. side compared to hundreds and hundreds of men. And I can't even count, like, buyers on the other side of things. I mean, I can think of one in the UK and one in France right now, but the majority of buyers are going to be men. So we also have this situation where so much of the financing of the movie depends on men making deals with men.
But there are plenty of successful films made by women. It's not necessarily financially unsuccessful if a film is made by a woman.
Oh, that couldn't.
On women's subjects.
Absolutely true.
So-called women's subjects.
There's no reason why this should be going on. We are seeing a marketplace where movies made by, for, and about women are making lots of money. So that's the good news of this discussion because, I mean, the most exciting and interesting thing to me is what's gone on with teenage girls as an audience, because for years and years, there was a Hollywood frustration that it's impossible to get young females to come see movies. And that's something young boys will do, but young girls would rather do other things. Twilight was the breakthrough when somebody realized a very real fact, which is that young women read serialized novels. They just do. They read more than anyone reads, frankly. But this interest in a serialized character over multiple books and multiple adventures, particularly when dealing with teen issues and problems of, you know, adolescence and growth and love and who am I, you know, huge movie franchises are about this. And girls read these. And then now we've seen, you know, seeing the success of Twilight, Hunger Games, Divergent, Fault in Our Stars in a row. I mean, literally, and The Giver coming out next, which is going to work too, in my opinion.
And most of those books were written by women.
Those are women wrote the books, girls read the books, and not only are they coming to the theater, they're coming in droves multiple times and practically toppling the buildings.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kathy Schulman. She's the president of Mandalay Pictures and the president of Women in Film, and she has won her own Academy Award for her movie Crash. Well, let's talk about you're running Mandalay Pictures.
Yes.
So you're in an opportunity to hire lots of women.
Yeah.
Do you?
Well, I'm not really in that opportunity. Mandalay Pictures is a producing company. We don't generally finance our movies. So what we do is we find content and we develop it and we package it, which means, you know, we put directors and writers and actors together, but we still need to find a financing source. So I'm not really in the hiring role on most films. When it comes to the decision of financing the movie, I always bring the candidates. And I bring women all the time. However, it's been pretty much an utter failure for me, except last year for the first time in over 20 years, when I was able, you know, with my colleagues to get a job for a woman. Her name is Marjane Satrapi, wonderful filmmaker.
And she did French. Persepolis.
She did Persepolis. Yeah. And she's amazing. And she just directed a film for us called The Voices that comes out through Lionsgate in February. And that was great. But like for somebody like me who devotes so much of my time to women's issues, you know, having to do with media, my own inability at my level of being a producer to get women jobs is terribly frustrating. I was thinking about it this morning before this, you know, interview, like, why is that happening? And I mean, you just can't say, well, that I'm developing those scripts badly and the other scripts well. You know, I've been trying to make a movie right now with a female director named Cindy Shupak. It's called Whatever Makes You Happy. And we're going to get this film made. And it stars some amazing women. But I've made four movies while trying to make this movie. I don't really get it. I actually think this script is probably the most commercial of the bunch. But it is so damn hard to get people to accept the female filmmaker combined with the female producer and the female actors, although there are men in it too. So I always try to put my money where my mouth is, but I've had very personal experiences of meeting up against these obstacles just as much as anyone else has. It's really why I'm committed to the cause.
So how is it for you as someone who has been able to produce successfully?
Yes.
How do you not say, well, if I could do it, you know?
It's all about sharing and teaching, and that's what Women in Film is all about. I mean, we have to attack the issue from two different sides. Basically, we need to do myth-busting and reassessment of people's own internal politics on the financing level. That has to do with our outreach to studios and to independent financiers and to networks and to agencies to sign clients, you know, who are female. On the other side, though, and equally as important and the place where I enjoy working the most is how can we prepare women to deal with the current existing state of financing? Because I want to say that there are some really recognizable habits that I see in women that are making the road more difficult than it should be. And I don't want to stereotype, and there are listeners going to say, you know, how dare you say that women have anything to do with this problem or the victim? But it's not true, because in many, many cases, women are uncomfortable with the notion of demanding limited resources for their work. So that's where the teaching is. How do you become a woman who can successfully demand limited resources?
To be more like a man in that
department. I don't know. Or to be more like a professional. It's hard in many cases for women to, when somebody says, you know, I don't see the value of this movie being $10 million. I don't get it. You better be able to answer by saying exactly why the value is $10 million.
And you don't see women doing that as much as they should?
I see some. It's rarer. It's certainly rare with directors. Like, I mean, I spent an hour and a half with a filmmaker on the phone this morning, and she submitted a business plan for her new movie, and it was terrible. 100% pass. And here's the thing.
And what was wrong with it?
And I said, but your script is good. So the plan is horrible. Well, she was asking financiers to give her, let's say the budget was $5 million of this independent film. She wanted financiers to give her $5 million to finance her film. That's not how we finance films. We finance films based on equity portions of balanced spreadsheets that have to do with foreign pre-sales and subsidy money, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, well, I don't know anything about that. I'm just a filmmaker. And I said, well, this is one of the things we're teaching at Women in Film. That's not going to work for you these days. Like, to be a director, there's a reason it's called show business, not business business or show show. Like, we have to know both sides.
Kathy Shulman, she's an Academy Award-winning producer, president of Mandalay Pictures, and president of Women in Film. Kathy, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, Dear White People. It started as a Twitter feed and turned into a satirical movie centered around four black students at a predominantly white college. My conversation with the director, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 4 years ago, a young filmmaker named Justin Simeon started tweeting as @DearWhitePeople.
Dear White People, the single ladies dance is dead. Please turn off your webcams and go about your lives.
2 years later, Simeon uploaded a concept trailer to YouTube, that is, a trailer for a movie that he hadn't made yet.
Forget Hollywood and forget Tyler Perry.
Yeah, forget Tyler Perry.
Like, can we get a movie with, you know, characters in them instead of stereotypes wrapped up in Christian dogma?
Yo, Lucas, I want my $15 back for Red Tails 2.
Most people are here to see Fang 9.
The highly stylized trailer featured a young woman on a preppy college campus with a radio show called Dear White People.
Dear White People, breaking news. The amount of black friends required to not seem racist has now been raised to 2.
In less than 24 hours, 80,000 people had watched the trailer, and Simeon had raised $10,000 for his movie. The buzz continued right up to the night when the actual movie debuted at Sundance last January and continued to the day it opened in theaters last October. It's about four black students with different identities attending a mostly white college. The tagline for the movie is a satire about being a black face in a very white place.
Together, we can bring black back to Winchester.
Who does Sam think she is?
It's like Spike Lee and Oprah had some sort of pissed off baby.
Justin Simeon's here to talk about his movie. Welcome. Congratulations.
So happy to be here. Thank you so much.
What a long journey it has been.
It's been even longer than this. You know, my first draft of this was a script called 2% that I wrote in 2006, my senior year in college. So it's been a journey.
Okay, so the Twitter feed, was it a way of raising money?
Honestly, the Twitter feed was a way for me to sort of like find jokes for Sam. Like once I identified,
Sam is the lead character.
Samantha White is the lead character, and once I sort of identified, you know, dear white people, such and such and such and such, a thing that she would say in the script, and as a thing that she would do on the radio, I needed material, and I also was just curious how people would react to that. So I started this Twitter account, and the things I got the most tweets and you know got the most response. Those are really the ones, the dear white people isms that kind of end up in the movie. It was just a way for me to kind of write during the day, because that wasn't my day job. And, you know, by the time I got home at night and was trying to crack jokes in my screenplay, it was gone. You know, the magic was gone. So it was a way for me to kind of comment and keep the wheels turning as I was, you know, doing other things to pay the rent.
So, dear white people, who is it for? Who are those, I don't know, those words of advice for? Are they for white people, or is it kind of a joke about black people who give advice to white people?
You know,
or
both? I think it's really, you know, the title is really meant to get people talking. You know, I think I made a movie where I want people to kind of come into the movie ready to think about it critically and kind of ready to have a conversation. And I think it's a title that's a little provocative, makes you wonder what the movie is going to be exactly. But it also kind of serves as a bit of commentary, because in a lot of ways, you know, the movie really does deal with these four black characters who are trying to find their identities. And all of them are kind of crafting their identities in response to the sort of white mainstream culture on their campus. So in that way, you know, in that way, all of them are kind of a dear white people of sorts, you know. But I think the ultimate goal for all of them is to sort of craft their identities from an authentic place, and not one that's in response to, you know, the pressures of the mainstream culture. So that's a highfalutin way of saying, you know, I wanted to get butts in seats with the title. And frankly, my working title, which was 2%, because it's about the 2% black population at this college, you know, just wasn't as it didn't roll as trippingly off the tongue.
Right. So it was attention grabbing. It sounds
exactly.
More like milk.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
So you have said that this film isn't really about white racism or about racism at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's about identity, you know, and I really tried to approach it as, you know, it's a part of the human condition, the sort of struggle between who we really are, how people see us, our identities. And I am talking about that through a black lens, because that's the one I got. But ultimately, I wanted to make a movie and say something that anybody can sort of find themselves in somewhere. And in doing so, I'm also able to sort of put forth, you know, a kind of vision of black life that I think is very seldom seen in the movies.
But you do illustrate a lot of racist incidents.
That's true.
That happened to your characters.
I think it's just inauthentic to sort of tell a modern, complicated story about black identity and not have sort of racism exist in the world or on the characters, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it's a wonderful ideal to sort of, you know, tell a story where the lead is black and that's never brought up. But that's not been my black experience.
Right. And so Sam, she's an interesting character because she's biracial.
Yeah.
And then she's chosen to identify with the black side.
Right. And I think that really is a thing that's, I think, particularly unique to, I'd say, in quotes, marginalized groups, is a sense that, like, because you're kind of constantly bobbing and weaving around other people's impressions of you, you kind of have to pick one at a certain point. And I, you know, that's certainly a pressure that, like, my mother felt. You know, my mother is Creole, so it's not quite biracial, but she's sort of, you know, ethnically ambiguous, and people don't know what she is. And she made a decision early on, like, I am a black woman. And I'm putting that out there before anyone can sort of make their own presumptions about who and what I am. And that is something, you know, that particular kind of pressure was relayed to me by a lot of people who are biracial. And frankly, it's just a pressure of being a black person, because, you know, I mean, for me, like, I didn't, you know, when I arrived on my college campus, and was kind of, you know, talking with kids who had never really spent a lot of face time with actual black people. And they were wondering, like, why am I not like the other black people on TV? And I had to sort of, you know, very quickly on my feet come up with what kind of black person I was. And that was a pressure that I felt was so unique to my experience and also so absent from the cultural conversation that, you know, that's really where the movie came from. It's like I wanted to articulate that particular aspect of the experience.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think a lot of people try on identities in college.
Yeah. There's this pressure to sort of, like, you know, everything, it's all coded into the college experience of having to pick your major right away, you know? There is this pressure to sort of, like, hang your hat on an identity, because I think that's the way, especially now in the age of the selfie, like, that's where we're at. Your identity really is probably the best tool that you have to sort of get on in the society. And for people of color, you know, our race is always kind of mixed up in that identity in some way or another.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Justin Simeon. He wrote, directed, and produced the movie called Dear White People. So I'm wondering, as a filmmaker then, did you struggle with that okay, I'm a black filmmaker, then I have to make a movie about race.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, you know. But the real struggle was, like, you know, this organically just was what I wanted my first film to be. And the funny thing about it is it was nothing like any of the other black movies in the marketplace. And so because I didn't fit the kind of current black mold, it was very difficult to sort of make this movie in the traditional channels, because it didn't look like any of the other black movies that had made money in the past, you know, year or so. And so, you know, even though we were sort of taking the script around and we had had the concept trailer and had national press attention and a million views for a movie that did not exist yet, you know, it was impossible to kind of get our project through the business affairs part of the studios, because, you know, we weren't the kind of black people they were looking for, I guess. Or,
and what were they looking for? What kind of black people were they looking for?
They were looking for the stories that made money in the past. You know, they were looking for those great, epic, tragic stories of the black experience, you know, be they about a sort of, you know, kid in modern day America, or, you know, something from the civil rights era, or slavery. Or they were looking for something lighthearted, popcorn friendly, you know, upwardly mobile black people falling in love in New York or whatever. You know, they were looking for the things that they knew, you know, could make money. The idea of making a sort of movie about black people that had an art house sensibility, that's not something we've really done in a while, at least not done for the masses in a while. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be at the 25th anniversary of Do the Right Thing, and Spike was like, yeah, Do the Right Thing would never happen at the studio level. Like, it would be impossible to make that movie at the studio level. And that's true. And it's kind of a tragedy. But, you know, that's just the way it is right now.
One of the characters, it's interesting you mentioned Spike Lee, because one of the characters in your movie, Lionel, he really reminded me of, is it Mookie from?
Oh, wow. That's so cool that you saw that connection. Yeah.
Well, he did. He sort of had that same kind of deer in the headlights look about him.
What am I doing here? That's so awesome. You know, if I may get into, you know, archetypes, story archetypes, my favorite archetype in a multi-protagonist story is the knave. You know, there's this character that sort of doesn't pick a side until the very end of, you know, most multi-protagonist stories. And most multi-protagonist stories tend to be about, like, are you a part of, or are you against, you know, the thing, that, you know, whether it's a society or the workplace or whatever it might be. And Lionel doesn't pick a side, much like Mookie doesn't pick a side, really, until, yeah, you know, he's kind of forced to by the narrative. So I love that you said that, because I always saw a connection between Mookie and Lionel, you know?
And how much of it was drawn from your personal experiences in college? Are you any of those characters? Are you some of those characters?
I think I've been all of them, certainly. You know, I think I entered college as a Lionel, kind of unsure about my identity and, you know, a little afraid of the uber cool black kids.
Did you have a huge afro? I didn't have a huge afro.
I had a halfro, okay? So it was deep enough for, you know, a white finger or two to find its way in there, but it wasn't the big, you know, giant monstrosity that Lionel has to wear in the film. But yeah, I kind of entered not sure where I fit in that particular world. And I left a little more militant. I left a little more Samantha White, you know. Uh-huh. But especially since entering the workplace, I've been Troy. I've been the guy that's sort of like living, you know, the vision of the people that came before me. But I've also been Coco, kind of playing up and down different aspects of my identity that I thought would work for me in the moment. And, you know, I'd like to think that now I've sort of reconciled all of the voices in my head, but I can certainly identify with all of them.
There's a great scene where Troy is trying to get in with these white guys and with their satirical magazine.
Right, right.
And he's sort of playing black.
Yeah.
Playing blacker than he plays when he's not, when
right.
he's with black people.
Right,
it's
right,
kind
right.
of funny.
Yeah.
And then Samantha is sort of narrating this, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. this whole thing. Can you describe that scene?
Yeah, it's a scene where, you know, he's sort of, he's trying to get into this humor magazine, and he finds that sort of self-effacing black jokes, you know, kind of slays that particular crowd. So he goes for it. And he plays up his blackness in that particular moment in a way that he doesn't have to with other black people, because, you know, the experience of being black is one that they're all familiar with already. But he can play it up for laughs within this arena, and that is absolutely something that I can relate to.
Really?
And yeah, and it's just something, you know, I found myself just doing at dinner parties or like in the workplace, and, you know, and I felt ashamed about it, but ultimately, it's sort of, you know, it's kind of what you do sometimes. And I wanted to kind of tell a dirty truth in that moment, that we all kind of play up elements of our identity, I think, sometimes to get what we want. And, you know, the real question that we have to ask is, when is that at a sacrifice, you know, of who we actually are and, you know, what it means to be our authentic selves?
And also, what does the dominant white culture want from Black people? Because it seems, you know, another part of your film, the message of your film, if I may, is that there is this fascination that white culture has had with Black culture since forever. And it plays out in that particular scene, too, that they want to be around this kind of what they envision as authentic Black culture without fully understanding it. And then Troy is trying to also play into those expectations.
Right.
So it's really complicated.
Yeah, I think it's the novelty of it, you know? I mean, just look at twerking. You know what I mean? It's sort of, I think the mainstream culture, whatever you want to call that, and at this moment in time in America, it is white dominated, you know? But the mainstream culture is always sort of interested in the quirky, exotic, novel, you know, thing that is new and different and on the cutting edge. And, you know, oftentimes that thing then becomes the mainstream. And then can sometimes be an oppressive force, because when you talk about Black culture, and I put that in air quotes, it tends to be the thing that like shoe companies and radio companies and music companies are just using to sell a product. It doesn't actually reflect the day-to-day life and culture of actual Black people anymore. And then, you know, you have people like actual Black people who don't relate at all to air quotes Black culture and then feel like they're not Black enough. And it's this weird sort of like cycle that we don't even have control of our own culture anymore. And I wanted to talk about that and how odd that can be for a person trying to find their identity in this world when, you know, an identity is sort of being pushed upon you that you can't relate to.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for asking such great questions. It was a pleasure.
It was great talking with you.
Yeah, you too.
Justin Simeon, writer, director, and producer of the new film Dear White People. It comes out on home video in February. Next up, Future Folk. It's a movie, it's a band, it's a way of life for two guys who decided to play bluegrass music dressed up as space aliens. That's next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Madeline Brand. You're listening to Press Play. The History of Future Folk is a movie about space aliens who come to Earth to destroy it, but end up playing bluegrass instead. They bill it as the only alien folk duo science fiction action comedy ever made. And how could you argue with that? Variety called it Close Encounters of the Charming Kind.
So, for those of you who don't know me, my name is General Trias, and I come from the planet Hondo. I was sent here to Earth to enact a doomsday device that would destroy the human race forever. You guys shouldn't be laughing. I'm talking about destroying the entire human race. And it's not... All right, well, you must like flesh-eating viruses more than most of the life forms I've encountered.
The story of aliens coming to Earth is, of course, made up, but Future Folk, the band, is real.
Hondo, years ago, all alone and walking down a dusty road, I met a multi-headed stranger.
For a decade, Nils Dallaire and Jay Kleitz have been performing in homemade red spacesuits as General Trias and his trusty sidekick, the mighty Kevin from the planet Hondo. And they're here now with us on Press Play. Welcome to Planet Earth.
Hondo!
What does Hondo mean? Is there a significance?
Well, for starters, it's our home planet.
And it's an expression that we use to supplement basically any positive adjective, also salutations and goodbyes. So it's a little bit like aloha.
Shalom.
Meets, yeah,
sure.
Shalom.
Shalom's a good example.
Meets grok. It's become our catchphrase.
We learned about marketing on Earth, and they said catchphrases are very important.
Yes,
so we've
indeed.
Been saying Hondo all over the planet.
Tell us how this Future Folk thing got started.
We had been playing music, and I think one night over beers had, you know, thrown out this idea of roots music from outer space, and then we were off to the races.
So, which came first, the outer space part or the roots music part?
The roots music part. I mean, I think just because I'm an acoustic guitar player, Nils plays many instruments, but the banjo particularly well.
I also play the badanjo.
The badanjo, which is what banjos are on Hondo, obviously.
Obviously.
There's an extra string. It's complicated.
So you play. You came. You were the band first, and then the movie came out of that.
Yeah, we were the band for many years.
And did you always play in costume?
Always.
Yes, and the costumes that we wear in the movie are high-rent versions of the costumes that we started out with. They were originally very DIY, essentially buckets with a face hole cut out of it and a red jumpsuit that gradually became more and more elaborate. Each show we would adorn it with new bells and whistles.
Okay, so your first song was what? The very first song you wrote as these bucket-headed aliens.
One of the first songs we ever played is one that we still play. It's called Space Worms. It's sort of become our anthem.
Well, I guess we need to hear it now.
Yeah, I mean,
and
have
no
to.
Pressure, but
all right, one, two, three, four.
Oh well, I grew up on a planet farming space worms, where space worms can always be found. Here on Earth, as far as I can discern, there just ain't no space worms around. What can I do? I'm simple farming man, light years away from my home. It's mighty hard to farm this planet's land, where space worms refuse to grow. Oh well, I grew up on my planet farming space worms, where space worms can always be found. But here on Earth, as far as I can discern, there just ain't no space worms around. It's been struggle, but I refuse to stop. Farming worms is what I was born to do. If you can find me a real good space worm crop, honey, I'll be good to you. Oh, well, I grew up on my planet farming space worms, where space worms can always be found. But here on Earth, as far as I can discern, there just ain't no space worms around. There just ain't no space worms around.
Woo! Woo! You now have a following. You've been doing this for 10 years, right?
Yes.
When you first went on stage, what was the reaction?
We've played shows before where we just haven't been able to win people over. And
what happens then?
It's a little uncomfortable, but there, I think it's actually a good exercise as an artist and also just as a human being to bomb. It's always a little uncomfortable.
But you can kind of use the costumes as armor in a way, right?
Yeah,
like a shield,
sure.
Like you can say, oh, it's not really me.
That's an excellent point, yeah. We are in character, you know, to a certain extent. And you're right, I think just the physicality of having another layer between you and the audience does make that a little easier. Mm.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jake Leitz and Nils Delaire. They are future folk aliens and bluegrass musicians. Okay, so let's talk about the movie. Your planet Hondo is about to get hit by a meteor and be rendered into oblivion.
That's right.
So you decide to, well, not you, Jay, Nils.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As Trius,
yep.
General Trius.
Correct.
To kill everybody on Earth.
That's right. And
so you can take over the planet.
Exactly. And I'm about to flip the switch.
When?
When I hear music for the first time
in
a Costco and it stays in my hand. I hear Muzak.
That's always been a part of our act since the beginning, that we didn't have music on Hondo. And, that's a great gift that we discovered upon arriving at Earth.
And then, Kevin, you're sent down to kill Trius because he's not getting the job done.
I'm sent to finish the job.
Yes.
And I intend to
do
it.
And you, too,
yeah.
Are transported.
Yes, and I am
by the
intoxicated
power of music.
With music.
Yes.
And it's glory.
And there's a great scene where you, Nils, play the history of music on your banjo.
You know, part of John Anderson Mitchell's wonderful screenplay had this scene where, essentially, without saying a word, I convert the character of Kevin from an enemy into basically an ally through playing on the banjo a medley of royalty-free music that spans across the ages.
Which Nils very aptly is composed, the right word, I don't know.
Arranged.
Arranged, yeah. That's better. Arranged.
It ends up in, was it O Fortuna? Which to me always was a very fun and obviously very cinematic song that's ubiquitous in movies. So I thought that would be kind of a fun thing to end on.
So then you're converted.
Yes, I'm immediately astonished by the power of music, and I the scene sort of gets to its climax, and I let out this giant operatic note of music for the very first time.
Musical ecstasy.
Yes. That's right. And then I karate chop him and run away.
Yeah. Based on real life.
I do that to him all the time.
Yeah. I like it.
So, you like it?
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of real life, have you guys ever performed as Future Folk on a bill with people who aren't aliens? And how do they react to you?
We have. We've played in all kinds of scenarios. We've played at stand-up comedy shows where we're the only musical act. We've played at musical shows where we're the only, I don't want to say novelty act, but we're the only novelty act. And, you know, I think that coming out with the costumes is a bit of an advantage and a disadvantage. Obviously, you command people's attention when you walk out wearing something outrageous. But at the same time, you have to work a little harder to win people over musically. Mm.
I think one of the things, the fairly universal reactions, whether it's the audience or another band or another comedian or whoever that's there, is that we walk out in these ridiculous spacesuits, and I think initially people assume that it's going to be a very goofy act, and on some levels it is, but our idea has always been that you have to combine the sort of highbrow and the lowbrow at the same time. Like, we aim to have solid, you know, bluegrass music, but kind of goofy space lyrics at the same time. We kind of like putting those two things that don't go together.
But do you think that you're kind of trapped in these personas, or do you think that you can shed them eventually? And
I'm trapped, I'm happy to be trapped.
Okay.
Yeah. For me, I get actually asked that a lot. Like, doesn't it get old singing about outer space? To me, there's something very exciting about the creative limitations of that construct, and try and push that beyond something that's just a gimmick act. And with novelty songs into something that has a real emotional relevance.
Well, thank you both for coming in.
Our pleasure.
And dropping by on our humble planet.
So happy to be here.
Don't kill us.
I promise we won't.
Nils Dallaire on banjo, Jay Kleitz on guitar, and they are the alien bluegrass duo Future Folk. You guys want to play us out with one last song?
Sure. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
House-sized house flies, eyes 5 feet wide, 50-foot wingspan. Fleas and bees as tall as trees, ants bigger than a van. On planet Hondo, the insects grow quite slow, till they've grown quite large. Their pincers are fierce, spikers that pierce, their teeth are sharp and long. Yeah, but they never sting, and sometimes they sing. But mostly they're just doing that thing. Yeah, but they're 12 feet tall, with sharp poison claws. But the thought of conflict just makes their skin crawl.
Hondo.
Hondo!
Well, that's it for the very last edition of Press Play for 2014. Happy New Year, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you in 2015.